Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley. Bit of housekeeping before we begin. Do you want to come and see us doing the podcast live? Well, on Wednesday of this week, so if you're listening to this in December, then frankly you're too late. But on Wednesday this week, Patrick McGuire and I are doing a very special edition of PMQ's Unpacked live at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. So if you're knocking around Cheltenham Wednesday lunchtime, just go online, search PMQ's Unpacked Cheltenham, and you can find all the details. And we're doing the radio show and the podcast live in front of hundreds of people. What could possibly go wrong? I'm also in Cheltenham for the whole week doing my radio show, and I'm doing a panel called Personality Politics, interviewing Jess Phillips. And on Saturday night, I'm doing the first outing of a new stand-up show. So if you are in Cheltenham, just go online to the Cheltenham Literature Festival and you can find all the details there. It'd be lovely to see. If you can't make it to Cheltenham, but you'd still like to come and talk to me on the radio, well, you are in luck. Come on and play our quiz. Can you get to number 10? 10 questions loosely connect to 10 cabinet jobs. The more questions you get right, the better the job you get. Taking your place alongside our listeners and guests. Just email me now with your name and your number, matt.chorley@times.radio, and we'll get you on the radio to do the quiz very soon. Right, I think that's enough housekeeping for now. Coming up on today's episode, an absolute cracker, the legend that is Peter Brooks, Times cartoonist. Next year, he'll have been doing it for the Times for 30 years. He joins me to discuss his new book, a collection of 2 years' worth of cartoons. We discuss how he does it, has he ever regretted a cartoon, the whole process of doing cartoons. It's cartoons on a podcast. What could possibly go wrong? So that's coming up. But first, it's our columnist panel. No Rachel Sylvester today. So it's Libby Purvis, and from The Atlantic, Tom McTague. Let's begin with the thing that we've had lots of messages from people saying, why are you talking about this? Because that's always a good place to start. This Treasury row with the Treasury accusing the Treasury accusing the business secretary of making things up about whether or not the Treasury was offering to help business deal with high energy bills. And Libby, the thing that strikes me, two things are interesting. One part of the government accusing a cabinet minister of making things up is quite interesting. Two, one part of the government boasting almost they're not even thinking about offering any help to businesses right now is also worth commenting on. What's your take on it, Libby?
Well, as to the Treasury spokesman rudeness, I think, as usual, the Queen does it better. You know, expressions like recollections may vary would be just that bit politer rather than, you know, this minister is always making things up in interviews, though heaven knows many of them do seem to make things up in interviews. But no, I find that actually distasteful. I mean, it's quite amusing for us when the cabinet is tearing lumps off each other, but it's not helpful to the country. And I'm just interested in this business of digging your heels in as well and not immediately saying yes, we'll give you lots of money. I mean, it is something sort of in a way quite useful. I mean, I think they should be moving towards support. And I think what the business secretary should have sort of said was not, oh, I'm doing it, you know, like a teenager tidying their bedroom. You know, he should have sort of said, we are going to start talking about this soon. But I think I am just interested. I don't know what to think, but I'm interested about the digging in the heels and saying, no, we're not actually going to just open the purse here. I think that's interesting to watch.
Tom McTague, part of this feels like it's part of the pattern which emerges with this government, which starts off with digging in of heels, and that lasts for a certain length of time, and then they go, all right, fine, we'll do something. And they did it with lorry drivers, they did it with factories producing CO2. We suspect that, you know, between now and Christmas, we'll find more and more parts of industry which actually do suddenly need help, giving help from the government. But it doesn't necessarily give the impression of a government which is in control of things when they say no, 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 like the guy from the Vicar of Dibley. It's just like no, 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 yes.
Well, it's sort of no, 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 no until Boris comes along and says, right, we're going to do this because I don't like the headlines. And then it becomes a yes, or a kind of grudging yes. And it's kind of reflective of this sort of Johnson government. Or he is perfectly happy with them all fighting because he doesn't mind the chaos, because as long as he's the king. And then it sort of structurally, you think it's just the same old Treasury dominant government, and the Treasury hasn't really changed its mind. It doesn't want to intervene and give people money, but the Prime Minister does, and he is powerful. So it's just a constant fudge between those two, I think.
I suppose, Libby, the really interesting thing is that when Tom says, you know, the Treasury, you know, is the dominant Treasury and we're back to sort of the old ways, is that Rishi Sunak only got the job as part of an attempt to neuter the Treasury. It was only, what, 18 months ago. Dominic Cummings, remember him? He wanted to impose number 10 special advisors on the Treasury team. Sajid Javid said no. He quit along with all of his advisors. And then Rishi Sunak was supposed to be sort of in the pocket of number 10, beholden to Boris Johnson. And yet it's actually given him more strength, if anything.
Well, this is because he showed himself so steady and inventive and fantastic at communicating in the early days of the pandemic. Nobody knew that was going to happen. I don't know how good Javid would have been, but Sunak, I think he raised himself above every level of being in the Prime Minister's pocket very, very quickly with that incredible sense of steadiness that he conveyed. I mean, we shall know in the long run whether it's all been the right thing to do or not, but it certainly has felt that way. And I can remember that sense of relief in the early days of the pandemic, that, yeah, here is somebody putting their arms around the country and sort of saying, look, you know, you're not all going to go bust straight away. You know, this is not the end of days. You know, we will help. We're a rich country. We will help. And I think he scored immensely on that. And I think, therefore, he's got quite a lot of stretch before people start getting thoroughly disillusioned with him. And if he says it's not the time to roll out enormous support to businesses, I think a lot of people will agree, will sort of say, OK, well, he maybe knows best.
Yeah, maybe he's got enough credit in the bank to do that. The other thing that strikes me, Tom, about this is maybe it's just the nature of news and politics right now, is that we just seem to go from being, you know, become experts in customs arrangements, then it was the R rates, then it was, you know, CO2 production. Last week we were all experts in how you go about carving up pig carcasses. This week it's the amount of gas that, you know, steelworks require. Is it healthy for us to have this sort of constant, you know, there have been lots of people saying Boris Johnson's gone on holiday in the middle of a crisis. And people have been pointing out, technically governments are always in crisis. That's what governments are there for, that, you know. Are we in a state of perpetual crisis? Does it do us any good, Tom?
Well, no, I don't think so. It does feel like we're in a state of perpetual crisis. I mean, it kind of feels like it's the shopping trolley analogy. It's the coming shopping trolley analogy, isn't it? It sort of feels like we just you know, bumble along, bashing from one thing to the next without sort of a clear idea of where we're going. What kind of economy is it we're trying to create, other than this sort of, you know, a general sense of levelling up? I don't think anyone is really clear, because I don't think Boris is particularly clear. So who emerges out of all this? As Libby says, it's this person who is incredibly calm and eloquent, but he's also very young. So who is behind him? He has this sort of institutional force of the Treasury, by far the most dominant department in Whitehall. And he's got rid of Cummings, who hates it. And who has he brought in? A former Treasury civil servant as Boris Johnson's chief of staff. So I get this sense of Boris doesn't care what's going on. He doesn't really sort of grip things, but the Treasury does, and they're keeping the show on the road.
Well, yes, while also insisting they're not actually doing anything about keeping the show on the road.
Yes.
Libby, let's talk about...
Can I just say this? This business of everybody suddenly being expert on lots of things. When I was a Today presenter, we all had to pretend we understood about the M3 money index. Anyone remember that? it was epidemiology of its day. Sorry, you were going to ask something.
Don't, Libby, give away the fact that we're all just pretending. to understand this. I really do know all about how to carve a pig. Libby, let's talk about your column today. It's about Jimmy Savile, and I confess I didn't see the ITV documentary last week, but people who did see it said it was, I mean, it was just, I mean, obviously utterly, utterly grim, sort of revealing the, what would they call, the portrait of a predator. And then the BBC are making a documentary about him, and part of me wonders.
BBC are doing a drama, sort of controversial. Yeah.
Do we need that? Do you think?
What I don't know whether we need the play or not. I mean, there was a very, very good stage play done with Alistair McGowan playing him, which was absolutely terrifying and actually quite useful. But no, I mean, there was nothing new in the ITV documentary. We all know the story. But what nobody says enough is that the way he burrowed into the feather bed of the establishment, you know, the way he had sort of the Prince of Wales and Cardinal Hume proposed him for the Athenaeum, and Mrs. Thatcher had him to Chequers. And I think a great deal of this was something which we don't admit to enough, which is inverted snobbery, that he was, for many of these people, including BBC mandarins, their token pleb. Oh, he's an ex-wrestler. You know, he was a miner, a Bevin boy. You know, he's ever so poor. Oh, he grew up poor. Oh, he's kind to his mum. Heart of gold. He's our northerner. Tick, tick, tick the boxes. You know, and then you don't look at the actual person and the actual sort of seediness and problematic nature and braggadocio of that person, because you're checking your privilege, you're being kind. And I think this is something which still goes on. I think quite a lot of checking of privilege causes us to be blind to the ways that certain people are twisting truth, you know, are twisting theories about gender and so on. It's the check your privilege inverted snobbery. And I think occasionally you need to call that out and say, look, sometimes you have to trust your own instincts and your own moralities and the things you have known all your life to be true and decent, and not say, oh, well, actually, it's the culture. You know, so there you go. That's what I'm saying. And some people are agreeing with me below the line, and others, as per usual, are absolutely not.
What do you make of this, Tom? I wonder whether it's more just about incredibly powerful, successful people that organisations rely on are very reluctant to call them out on it. Whether that has been, you know, whether it was Bill Crosby or R. Kelly, you know, when there's a lot of money involved, successful people, they do seem to get a free pass.
Yeah, they do. But I do think it is emblematic of a sort of wider problem. I thought the column was brilliant. It made me think about lots of different instances in our life where it's just too much hassle to be the one person who gets a name for themselves writing about a certain thing, whether it's gender or Brexit or anything else, where you think there's an obvious truth here. But I don't want to be the one to have to carry the can and get all of the grief for coming out and saying it. So the power of sort of social pressure is also something that I think is incredibly dominant. And that sense of that Libby talked about, of feeling you sort of going with your instinct rather than feeling the pressure. You know, it reminds me of this book I read recently where it said, you know, what we think of as irrational instincts are mostly just rational things, but we haven't yet quite understood the argument for it. We don't have the reasons, but we know it's rational somewhere, but it's dismissed as being irrational.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with this BBC drama, because whether or not we need to sort of essentially make entertainment out of something so dreadful, and the BBC sort of doing it now as a way to sort of show, we know it was awful. It might be better if there'd have been slightly more aware of that before. Just finally, Tom, let's talk about this piece that you've written about Newcastle in Saudi Arabia.
And... Oh, so brilliant.
Now, explain, if people are not close followers of the association football, explain what's gone on here, Tom, and then your take on it.
Well, it's an unrelentingly grim story, really. I mean, Newcastle is a traditionally big football club with big supporters. And it has this giant stadium that sits in the centre of town, but rather like a cathedral. You know, that was my sort of intro. It feels like a cathedral when you're there. It's the sort of centre of the city. And for so long, it's been owned by, you know, this awful man, Mike Ashley, who runs Sports Direct, and it's been plastered with Sports Direct franchises on the outside. And the whole place is just felt cheapened and kind of horrible, and they haven't achieved anything because he's, you know, essentially a very rich cheapskate. And Saudi Arabia have taken over, and the fans came out and they were celebrating en masse outside St. James's Park, some wearing, you know, their tea towels on their head, you know, which was rather, you know, un-PC. But then it just feels awful, and it feels kind of like, it feels like almost of an old age, an age where we did accept everyone's money. Anything could come into London as long as we made some money. It didn't matter. We had oligarchs, we had Arab billionaires coming here. I thought that kind of had gone, that felt old, and yet the Premier League lives on and people are celebrating it. Because it gets some money in. And I think it just shows a kind of lack of coherence in what, as a country, we want to be.
I loved what Tom wrote. I mean, I could have flung my arms around him, because the same thing happens in the property market. We have been pimping out the capital city and parts of other great cities to dirty foreign money for a very long time. You know, the incredible sort of buying up of not just millionaire palaces but huge blocks of new build flats and so on. It, you know, just going to money, which often is very dirty money, and nobody seems to understand how disgraceful this is. You know, how Britain has just been totally put up for sale for so long. And, I mean, Tom absolutely nails it.
There's also something about football in particular, Tom, that, and we saw it with the European Super League, where people still... people ignore the fact it's just a massive, quite grubby business with loads of money sloshing around. Actually, quite often, money from whether it's betting firms or dodgy regimes, whatever it might be. But because, you know, you can film someone kicking a football down the back of some terraced houses and, you know, put some Oasis on it, and you can create the illusion it's still this sort of earthy, community-based thing, and it's all, you know, people in flat caps and dads taking their sons and welling up and all that sort of... But it's none of those things, is it? It's just a massive corporate... You know, having Saudi Arabia coming in is no better or worse than the awful man from Sports Direct... and so, you know, Newcastle delighted they're going to buy more players, and maybe they'll do better. But everyone sort of, you know, but then it loses something else as a result.
Yeah, but it feels like a sort of, you know, sport by performance art or politics by performance art. It's all just nonsense. And it comes back to the Libby's piece. You know, we don't call this out. It's right in front of us. We know this nonsense is right there. But we sort of just go along with it because the whole thing is corrupt. So that, you know, as soon as you get that foothold, you know, the Russian oligarch buying Chelsea, that was one thing. Nobody said anything at the time. And then the UAE buy Man City and nobody says anything at the time again. And then suddenly the corruption is just everywhere. And you think, well, if everyone's corrupt, I may as well be corrupt. Because, what, you know, what is there to lose? I'm the mug here if I'm not corrupt. And that's the same in the housing market. That's the same in London. And you just think, well, this is somebody should just say it and call it out for what it is. And it does feel like, again, it's the sort of the token Northerners, Newcastle, you know, token Northerners, working class guys out there supporting them. Well, you can still say something's wrong.
I love the way you managed to pull everything together into one beautiful. Everything is awful. There we are. Lovely stuff.
But you do get into trouble for it.
Tom McTague and Libby post that. Of course, you can read Libby in the Times every week. Just get yourself a digital subscription. And as a bonus right now, you get your first 3 months for just £3. Go online to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is my chat with Peter Brooks.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for my chat with the legendary Times cartoonist, Peter Brooks. Now, I was looking up when I knew you were coming in. Next year, you mark 30 years at the Times.
Do you know, you're probably right. I haven't been counting.
So it's 1992, I think it says.
It's 1992, you're right.
When you started.
Yeah, yeah.
And how... When you started back then, how much has your style or your approach changed?
Well, the style's changed a fair bit because in those days we were black and white.
Oh, okay.
I used to work in a rather sort of heavy laboured, cross-hatched way, which is pen and ink, black and white. And then we went into colour, and so the whole thing changed, and I had to learn a whole lot of new tricks. And I wasn't very good to start with, I have to say. I don't know how good I am now, but I've had enough practice, put it that way.
Well, I'll tell you what, before you start being with your faux modesty, already we've had messages coming in saying, Peter Brooks is unmatched in his artwork, wit and satire, the highlight of the Times, hope he keeps gracing the paper. So plenty of people are massive fans. Talk me through the process then. It's just gone 11 o'clock in the morning. Talk me through your day. How do you go from something happening in the news to you producing basically this incredible piece of artwork that's in tomorrow's paper?
Right. Well, I start at 6:30, listening to the Today programme. I mean, I'm not out of bed.
All Times Radio breakfast, obviously.
All Times Radio, yeah. It has been, in the past, has been Radio 4. But anyway, I'm listening to the radio and listening to the news as I'm getting up and all the rest of it and getting ready. And since March last year, I've been working from home. So it's an easier process to get from downstairs up to the top of the house than it is to get into work here at the news building. Although it doesn't take me long. I'm only 11 minutes away. So that was always quite a good journey. So I was in here for the morning conferences, and there are two morning conferences. There's a quarter of an hour one, which is to do with section heads throwing ideas around, and I will listen into that now on the phone, and it's very helpful, but it's only a quarter of an hour. And then the main conference is about an hour in length, and that's very useful indeed. But that's 10:30 to 11:30, and anything can happen during the rest of the day, and you have to be ready to adapt what you've been doing or change it altogether and start again later in the day if that's the case. So it's a matter of juggling things. And by 3 o'clock, if I haven't got an idea of where I want to go, because that's the point of it, really, is the idea is the main thing. And the drawing, you have to allow yourself enough time to do it properly, because I take up half a page in the Times, myself and my colleague Morten Morland. And so the drawing has to be of some substance, really. Otherwise, people will be very fed up with a sketchy little thing that doesn't amount to anything.
And I suppose part of the reason of you sort of listening into the news conference, knowing what's on the news list and what's happening, is it sometimes, I suppose, by doing that, that's how you get the brilliant cartoons which combine two news stories of the day. You know, there's a story about, I thought it might be, about James Bond on one
that's
page
right.
of the paper,
yeah.
And then there's a story about Gavin Williamson on another part of the paper, and then you can bring the two together.
Yeah, for some reason, and I don't know why, but it seems to work when you do that. People laugh or people get a connection. That, I mean, the difficult thing I've got is in analysing humour. It's what Barry Cryer said, you know, it's a bit like dissecting a frog. Nobody laughs and the frog dies. And so you can't really, how you put these things together, just it's serendipity often.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And people connect with
it. And sometimes they will, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
So you get to about 3 o'clock, hoping you've got an idea in your head.
Yeah.
How, talk us through the process then. Do you draw it with pencil first? Talk us through the entire sort of creative process, how long it takes.
Well, I say 3 o'clock, but I generally aim for earlier than that. And I have a book, which is a sketchbook, in which I do a pencil drawing of the way I see it. And it's important to me to sort of map out just how the structure of the cartoon is going to be. Having got a germ of an idea, I'll put it down in this sketchbook, and then I'll photograph it and send it to the editor of the comment pages, who is now Roland Watson. I send it to him, and he gets back to me, and we have a little discussion about it, or he gives me a thumbs up, or he rings up and queries what on earth I'm going on about. So that's decided.
I didn't realise that you had that sort of... Because I have to, when I'm doing my column for Roland, I have to do the same thing. I'll send him literally a sort of... sketched out in words what I might do my column on, and he'll say yes or no. But I didn't realise you literally send him a sketch.
I send him a sketch because it's easy to photograph it on your phone and send it. And, you know, describing it doesn't really help.
Yeah.
It's a bit like if I have to describe one of my cartoons to you now, no one can see what on earth I'm talking about. So it's much better to actually see it. And so he does that. And then in my mind, I have an all clear, if you like, you know, it's settled as to what I'm doing. And I can, it's not a vetting procedure at all. It's not like that. And in fact, I've been incredibly lucky over the years at the Times that nobody says to me, you can do this, you can't do that. It never happens and never has done. And anyway, with Roland during the day, I've got what I want to do in pencil. I then put it on my copying machine, blow it up to the size I want to do, which is the same, constant every day, exactly the same size, and makes life easy. And then I draw it out in pen and ink and watercolour, which is what I use.
And how long does that process take? Because anyone who's ever tried watercolours will know that, you know, you need to let it dry and, you know, you don't want to get in like a big old mushy mess. How long does that process take?
Oh, that's true. But despite the fact, well, listeners can't see me, but I'm as bald as a coot, and I have a hairdryer, but not for my hair. I have a hairdryer to dry
that,
quickly.
That speeds up the process.
Speeds up the process, and it dries the pen and ink, and it dries the watercolour very quickly. And because speed is of the essence, really. And I suppose it's difficult to judge, and I'd hate every day to be exactly the same. Luckily, it's not, because some drawings are going to take you longer than others, and some. I mean, I'm lucky in that I'm old enough now, pushing 80, that I've done this long enough to know how to gauge how long someone's going to take me. And magically, it always finishes at about 7:30, which is when I really have to file, or even a bit earlier sometimes.
And what happens if at about 6 o'clock, you're halfway through, you know, you're well on your way to being finished, blow-drying away along, and the person you're doing a cartoon of resigns, or the story that you're essentially commenting on dramatically changes? What happens then?
What happens is I go into a flat spin, to put it politely, and I won't suggest any other bodily function that sort of makes you disturbed and worried about these things. But, it can be pretty hairy. But then if I've got time, I mean, the default position is just to carry on and expect people to realise, well, it was obviously too late for him to do anything about it, so I can't expect him to have done that story. But people don't, for some reason. People think you're sitting there. This isn't to demean what readers think at all, but I know that some people think you're actually, you know, inking in every newspaper at about 8 o'clock in the morning before they get it through the door. And it's immediate. It's not quite that immediate because I've got to finish by 7:30. I can go later. That's my answer to you, is that I can go later if it's absolutely necessary. And if a huge story's broken, then the rest of the paper's going relatively late as well to catch up with it. So I'm allowed that.
You're allowed that for you. Yeah, you don't do it too often.
Yeah.
And how do you choose your targets? Because you essentially, I don't know, I've spoken to you about this before, you do treat it like, as a columnist, that you have a point of view.
Yes.
And you sort of pursue that point of view above all else. That's,
well, how I choose my targets is basically Johnson, Johnson and Johnson. And what I find, actually, I'm very chary about this, although some readers think I'm not, that I do him too often. But frankly, he's the only show in town as far as the cabinet are concerned. There are very few instances where you can draw a cabinet, another cabinet member who's done anything meaningful or newsworthy. It doesn't often happen. Priti Patel occasionally, I'll have a good swipe at her because, you know, I profoundly disagree with the way that she treats asylum seekers, the way they've been housed, all that sort of thing. It's unkind in many instances. And I find with Johnson, particularly latterly, for some reason, although I think he's always been like this, he doesn't care. And I just find that, awful. And his lack of empathy and sympathy, I just find unbelievable. And so I've been doing a lot of cartoons on that basis recently.
And how, it's sort of amazing because it's so instantly recognisable as Boris Johnson, and yet also doesn't look anything like, because it's basically the hair, isn't it?
Yeah, it is the hair. I mean, you don't see his eyes in my cartoons, the hair. And I've been doing this since early Spectator covers when he was featuring as, going for mayor of London. This was donkey's years ago, obviously. And I used to draw him exactly like that, and no vision, all that sort of thing, blind as a bat, to anyone else. So, he looks more like Stanley, actually, quite often than he does himself.
What about when you choose to do something more serious? In fact, I've just opened your book, and there's a cartoon of him. This is when the UK passed a sort of one of the terrible coronavirus milestones. And it's just Boris Johnson standing at a lectern at one of his coronavirus press conferences, but the lectern is a tombstone with 100,000.
That's right.
And not so normally people are flicking through the paper saying, I'll tell you who's going to make me laugh about all the news is miserable. I'll tell you who's going to make me laugh about this. But instead, you're making a serious point. How often do you that?
Quite often, because, the news isn't always a laugh a minute, as we all know. And you can use humour a lot. But at other times, you've got to be serious. And a political cartoon can embrace all these things, really. It can be shades of... It can be black humour. It can actually intend to make you laugh and pull these people down a bit. Basically, my feeling about what a political cartoon is, it's a bit... the best analogy I've ever heard, really, is you are basically the slave in ancient Rome standing on the back of the chariot as the general is riding through Rome to cheers and acclaim and all the rest of it, victorious, and you are whispering in his ear, you are mortal, you are mortal. And that's really what you're trying to do all the time, is actually bring these people down a peg or two, really. You're not probably going to change policy or anything like that. That's not really what you'd be mad if you thought you could. But you really want to give them a good kicking now and again, and that's a huge privilege to be able to take half a page on the paper to actually follow your prejudices, basically.
Well, I'm going to ask you in a sec whether how you feel then about politicians who buy your cartoons and hang it up in their downstairs loo. This is Matt Jordan. I'm speaking to Peter Brooks, Times cartoonist, about his new book, Desperate Times. More from Peter in just a moment. It's Matt Jolly on Times Radio in association with MasterCard Strive, empowering small businesses for a digital future.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with Strive UK from MasterCard, empowering small businesses for a digital future. Find out more at mastercard.co.uk/strive.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio, joined in the studio by Peter Brooks, the award-winning Times cartoonist. We've been doing it for 30 years next year. He's got a new book out called Desperate Times, which is a collection, a sort of terrifying collection of the past sort of 2 years, isn't it?
Yes,
Peter?
2 years.
Back in the days when all we had to worry about was Jeremy Corbyn, all the way through the arrival of COVID, the departure of Donald Trump, and right up to date now. We were just talking about how you're sort of trying to remind politicians they're more, give them a good kicking. And yet some politicians love being in cartoon. How do you cope with with the fact that you feel like you've given a politician a really good kicking, and then they try to buy the cartoon to put up in their downstairs loo?
Well, there's two sides to this. One is that luckily I can deal through a gallery.
so you don't have to deal with
them
direct.
So I don't deal with them direct, and I don't know who they are who buy them. Actually, I don't know who anybody is who buy them, apart from a few collectors who buy quite a few, and I got to know one or two of them, but not politicians. So that's the way it works for me. And by the way, I've got an exhibition on as of next week from the book.
So people can go and see them up close.
People can see them up close, which some people enjoy doing, and, you know, I'm happy to let them see them. And the other thing about politicians is that, you know, you hear them getting angry at cartoons, but they're more often more angry if they don't appear in cartoons. That's the cliche of it, and it's probably true.
Are you aware that your cartoon has ever changed either anyone's opinion or shifted policy or anything like that?
Well, Cameron once told me that a cartoon I'd done, which was a sort of flip-flop, I had him depicted as a pair of flip-flops, you know, his face. Yeah. It makes a beautiful, the shape of his face. It makes a beautiful rubber sole, basically. And he told me that one cartoon I did on that made him, it took him up short, or whatever the expression, pulled him up short, made him rethink something. I don't know what it was. That's probably, to put the kindest complexion on it, just what a cartoonist would get from a politician who's speaking to
him. And what about, because as well as drawing, you know, Boris Johnson with the hair over his eyes, over the years you've had Ed Miliband as Gromit.
Do you know, someone introduced me to Ed Miliband a couple of nights ago at the Cheltenham Literature Festival, which I did not want. And I did not want because I was scared or not wanting to defend or having to defend what I did. I didn't have to defend what I did. But it was the fact that politicians speaking to you about the cartoons you've done dissemble and they sort of, muck around and saying, oh, yes, of course, yes. No, I thought they were terribly funny. Oh, no, I loved all those. Whereas you...
So what did he say? What did Edward about say?
He said all that. You know, he said, you know, oh, no, I think they have a good place in, and it got very awkward in a sense, really, because I just said, well, I was doing my job. You know, that's what I do. And he didn't criticise them. He didn't say, but that's the worst thing, you know, because I happen to know that he didn't like them.
Well, but because you did it so much, I suppose, it probably did embed in some people's minds sometimes. You shifted people's perception of him.
It may well have done. And also, with Cameron, I had him as a public school toff and, the leader of the Lib Dems, dear Nick. I agree with Nick. Was his fag. And, I kept them going for about 4 or 5 years like that during the coalition.
And then what about someone like Keir Starmer, who's not the most colourful of characters?
No, he's not.
So what do you do about that? I mean, Theresa May was probably a bit the same as well.
Very much, yeah.
So do you have to almost make them more interesting in order to make them cartoonable?
Well, I don't think you can, actually. That would be an impossibility. But what you do is, I suppose, play on that to some degree. I can remember doing one or two cartoons where you're... making them say, I did an April Fool's cartoon where I had a whole array of, which is in the book, politicians all saying, because it's April Fool's Day, all saying the opposite of what they actually believed. And I remember Keir Starmer was saying, I've got something very interesting to tell you. and so you play on that fact that he was much more interesting to draw earlier on, strangely, because his hair stood up like a sort of punk hairstyle, but now he's all smoothed out. Whatever you think of these people as a cartoonist, you know, you've also got to think of them as someone you either... whose politics you agree with or you don't agree with. And that's really, the name of the game, really.
And given you produce so many, you do, was it three a week?
I do four a week.
Four a week now. Are there any that you regret that you now look back on, or have any that have got you into trouble?
Oh, several have got me into trouble. Oh, yeah. But I don't regret them. Not at all.
Which ones in particular have got into trouble?
Well, there was Pope Benedict. I did a cartoon of Pope Benedict, which got me the most...
You got properly ticked off for that one, didn't you?
Not only properly ticked off, the editor did too, and the editor was summoned to, you know, the Cathedral of Westminster and given a real ticking off.
Explain what your cartoon was.
It was because Pope Benedict had issued whatever Pope's issue, an edict or an encyclical or whatever, before he was making a tour of Africa. This was a long, long time ago. This was in 2011, I think, something like that. And he put out this edict that condoms didn't help in the fight against AIDS, you know, which I thought was just especially in Africa, you know, huge, massive population of Africa. I just thought, oh, I've had enough of this. And I did a cartoon of him instead of the papal, whatever it's called,
mitre.
So, yeah. Well, yes, yeah, whatever the Catholic equivalent of that is. He had a condom on his head, and that went straight to the top table at the Vatican. It did. It went straight to the top table at the Vatican, along with a colleague of mine in France who works for Le Monde, Plantu, who did a cartoon, not the same idea, but on the same subject, and he and I were both talked about. In extremely strong terms, by the top team, which presumably means the Pope.
Now, knowing you as I do, I suspect you absolutely loved that.
I did, but you know, the strange thing is, I didn't set off to create a storm and get letters in the Times from the Cardinal of Westminster and all the rest of it. I didn't set off to do that.
And did you think when you were doing it, this might cause, because there must be someone you think this might cause trouble and then it sort of passes by without an incident?
Well, no, I didn't, strangely. I just thought it's another... because I've done quite a few, you know, cartoons that I think, you know... I don't know how to explain it, really. No, I didn't. And I think if I start thinking, oh, this is going to cause a ruckus, or yeah, I'm going to get them going with this one, it's the wrong way around. What happens is it's got to be the idea of what's happened has got to be the thing that motivates you and motivates the cartoon and gets you angry or gets you... Otherwise, you could go through life, you know, just being kind of slightly false and saying, you know, I'll just do this because I know it'll anger people, as opposed to I'll do this because I believe this is wrong.
That's what you actually think. And what about somebody got in touch about the recent one you did of Priti Patel...
Yeah,
with an argument for mandatory masks.
Oh yes,
which
yes,
is a lot of people putting lots of masks across.
Yeah,
that seemed to provoke a bit of a Twitter storm.
It did. Got a lot.
And people accused you of being sexist and misogynistic. Do you worry about that?
No, because all you've got to do now is draw a person of colour, and you're accused of being racist. You know, and that's part of this whole thing at the moment, and it's part of what was happening on this particular instance that these guys were getting attacked for taking the knee and all the rest of it, and she was saying they shouldn't be taking the knee and this, all this, and I can't remember exactly the limits of the story. Can you remember exactly?
Yeah, she said that they shouldn't be taking the knee, and then 2 weeks later had her England shirt on and was
yes, that's right, exactly, exactly.
Was, you know, claiming
that was some,
someone claiming credit for how well England were doing.
That was it. But no, I don't.
I have to say, I get exactly the same thing. If I were to do a column about Priti Patel, I get accused of being racist, even though I've previously done Boris Johnson, Matt Hancock, Gavin Williamson, whatever it might be.
And it's not just a question of you're exaggerating their features or anything like that, which I'm doing no more than I do with any other politician. It's just that they don't, they think, and because she's a woman, of course, that takes the stakes up even higher.
You're sexist,
misogynist,
as well.
And all the rest of it. Yeah.
Does social media, or just the internet in general, does that change? Because, like you were saying, you've gone from a black and white hatch drawing in the printed copy of the Times.
Yes.
Now you can be seen anywhere around the world. Does that change the topics that you choose? Do you take any notice of the sort of digital reaction you get, whether it's comments underneath or people on Twitter?
Well, I put my stuff up every day on Twitter after the paper's been out a little while, so that I'm allowed to do that a bit later on. You know, no, it hasn't changed anything, really. And Twitter's such a dangerous thing. You can be swayed. You can be lured into thinking, oh, look, I've got so many likes for this and I must do another one like it or similar. Yeah. And you shouldn't get involved in that.
Don't take any notice of Twitter. And just, but you talked about how you had to change your style Yeah. But you've been doing them like this for quite a long time now. Yeah. Is there any other styles of cartoonists or other cartoonists who you particularly admire or young cartoonists? There aren't many outlets these days, presumably, to be a young cartoonist.
No. Well, the difficulty they have, and I do feel sorry for young cartoonists, because the only way you can actually develop and get anywhere as a cartoonist is actually by doing it. And, of course, there they are sitting at home quite often. There aren't that many, actually, to be honest, who are trying to do this. There were more, it seems to me, about 10, 20 years ago than there are now. And maybe they see commentary being better served by, you know, being on the internet and being doing that sort of thing rather than being a newspaper cartoonist, because, as we all know, newspapers have got a finite life. But, of course, we and others are now on the net, and, you know, I much prefer the way my cartoons look, you know, on screen, because they're backlit and there's colours
much
work.
Brighter and the colours really pop rather than on dirty old print.
Dirty old newsprint. But that said, you know, I'm still very fond of newspapers, and I can't remember what we were talking about.
Anyway, have you got any advice for anyone who wants to
cartoonist? Oh, yes, indeed. Well, I mean, I've always been more than happy to see people who want to talk about it and to find ways of becoming a newspaper cartoonist. I mean, it's quite simple. Just wait for us to die.
I know, but you just keep on going, Peter. 30 years is still going strong.
Well, I said before, I'm pushing 80. I don't see myself doing it for that much longer. But I do feel sorry for them, because it's just a difficult process to get into. And there are only so many openings, and they're all full, you know. We're all working. Yeah. And so I just advise them to plug on with it and to keep trying if they can, but they've got to make a living as well.
Do it on the side. Just funny, your book, Desperate Times, is out now. What's your favourite cartoon in there? Do you have a favourite, or they're all like your children, they're all your favourite?
Do you know, I wouldn't say they're all my favourites. I think what I particularly like about the book, or the way the book's turned out, is that on the cover I've got Boris Johnson as Vicky Pollard, who's at Downing Street briefing. And instead of the podium saying, save lives,
stay at home,
it says, yeah, but, no, but, yeah, but, which is actually more and more what he's like. And on the last cartoon in the book is a similar configuration of Matt Hancock at the podium. And instead of saying, what does it say?
Instead of saying hands, face, space, it says hands, face, bottom.
Yes, and I wish I had the guts to say arse, but bottom was good enough.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget, you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio, and we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.